as you know, there have been times where in a stressful process, we've had to deliver news that wasn't the greatest. But the main thing is if we're communicating that and we're being clear about it, I think that's a big positive for you and your clients to hear.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Whenever we do these podcasts, we like to have a nice clear hook that we want to, you know, kind of tempt listeners with, you know, something that you're going to learn, something that you're going to pull away from this episode and a real actionable item. But sometimes it's really just good to sit down with a buyer who's been super experienced, has a proven track record of doing really, really good work and been successful in what they're doing. And today we have that sort of a guest. Joe, you sat down with Ben. Is it Carpel, or do we know?
You know what I think I say? I've been saying Carpel for years, but it's Carpel. We'll let him pronounce it properly and just go with that instead.
We really need to improve on this part of our podcasting career. Well, we should stick to brokering. All the same, Ben, we won't rank as far as how much different buyers have bought from us, but Ben is definitely one of our top five all-time buyers as far as what he's done through Quiet Light Brokerage. And you spent some time talking to him about how he's financing some of these deals, how he's been putting together money, and also just some of the things that we can pick up, you know, wisdom we can pick up from somebody who's done as much as he's done.
Yeah. If anyone out there listening is thinking about making an investment in a web-based business, they should listen to Ben's approach because it just makes me, the broker, want to work with him more and more and more. He's easy to work with. He's always trying to under-promise and over-deliver. He's continually giving updates. And he thinks first about the seller, trying to make the deal work for them. Naturally, it's got to work for him, but he doesn't mind overpaying for a great business that has incredible growth opportunities. He comes from, or came from years ago, the larger investment banking world, where he worked for a company, a family fund, and they would buy larger manufacturing companies. He took a lot of what his mentor shared with him there and brought it over into his own world, which is him working from his house and running two now multi-million dollar businesses. He's bought them both from me, purchased two or three others along the way, but it works. He's got a system in place and a process in place. And one of the most important, we'll touch on it, won't give away too much, but it's when he has money behind him, an investor, he brings that investor into the mix early on. And with a business that he bought recently, we had multiple offers. And Ben made the choice to bring the investor in on the original conference calls with the seller, and that sealed the deal. And that's why he was chosen over the other two.
That sounds great. Well, again, I think these conversations are super useful for anyone that is interested in just kind of being a fly on the wall for somebody that's been there, done that, and done that well. So why don't we go ahead and get to the interview and see what we can pick up.
Hey, folks, it's Joe Valley at Quiet Light Brokerage. And today I've got a very special guest. It's Ben Carpel. Ben is a buyer, and he's actually bought two of my largest listings, one for just under $9 million, another, by my math, just under four-ish. But that's just my math. It all depends upon how you work it out. Ben, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Happy to be here.
Glad you're here, man. Hey, listen, I would love for you to tell your story, let these folks know who you are. Give them a little bit of background on yourself, if you wouldn't mind.
Perfect. The quick overview is Midwest guy, born in Minnesota, actually where Quiet Light is based, or Mark is based. And I grew up kind of in the investing world, actually, a little bit. So I was doing institutional investing. What I mean by that is I was a investment professional. So I was a sourcing, negotiating, structuring, evaluating deals, always though in the context of managing someone else's money. So myself, my former colleagues, we are there to make investment decisions for investors in a fund, a larger fund. And about 6 years ago now, seven or eight, actually, maybe closer to it, was at a place that invested in a lot of growth companies, a lot of growing businesses and small businesses. And the trend I saw was it was entrepreneurs of all shapes and sizes. And I knew, Joe, since I was a little kid, like I knew I kind of wanted to always have that that operator in that entrepreneurial role, right? I just didn't know when or how or when or why or what it was going to entail, all those big questions. And I knew at a certain point it would happen. So kind of, I guess, really it was these digital acquisitions, the digital businesses that made my switch purely looking at investments into more, okay, now we have to deal with operations. So I wanted that. I wanted to seek out, we have customers to deal with. We have vendors and suppliers to deal with. We have strategy and marketing and sales to think about. Whereas in an investment role, you're thinking about that, but you're more disconnected from the actual operations of the business. So, yeah, like I said, about 6 years ago, we were seeing, again, a lot of people that had started businesses of all shapes and sizes, all different industries, and I was inspired by that and wanted to get into that. And I knew, I think location independence, especially now in 2018, is a big thing for a lot of us. And I knew web-based or digital-based businesses can be a path for that. Currently, I'm based in the West Coast, but open to living and moving, we're all over. I mean, I know a lot of your buyers come from all over the place. And I think it's a big advantage that Quiet Light Deals have brought to the table. Consistently, what I've seen and what we've bid on, there's a location independence factor to it. So that's a big plus for me. You can kind of put roots where you need to be for your kids or your family or your friends. You can choose to live and work where you need to be. That's been the case of the businesses, you and I have worked on together, as well as the ones I've seen. So all my ramble just there, the short version is former investor turned, I guess, operator via high quality Quiet Light Deals. And I got a chance to put my investment skills to work and do the things I craved in sales and marketing and customers and vendors.
Well, it's interesting from your former investment world where you were the investor in an institutional sense, did you find that the multiples were much higher than what you're looking at in this online world and
yes,
the owner operator space?
Very, very much the case. And it still persists to that day. So for the past decade, it's gone up and down a little bit depending on the broader economy and depending on supply and demand. But I can consistently say that when you're buying or when buyers and sellers are negotiating the standpoint of maybe a traditional brick and mortar business, such as a widget manufacturer, a factory manufacturer, if you will, those multiples or a distributor or a wholesaler, a publisher, whatever it may be, they tend to be higher. And so what's great for buyers in this space and buyers looking at Quiet Light Deals is they can, I would say, relatively more affordably put their business acumen to work without having to invest in, say, real estate or the public stock market or private businesses at this fund level. So you can get a little bit by definition, they're going to be smaller businesses. And so there is more risk than, buying into the S&P or an apartment building or whatnot. But if you are really willing to put the work in and evaluate properly and operate properly, I think the payoff can be really attractive from a buyer perspective. And then from a seller perspective too, I mean, they're working with you guys and you're giving them sage advice, you're giving them quality, just advisement of what to do. It's a path now that you didn't used to be. I think 10, 15 years ago, especially, if you've created a digital business or an online business, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to monetize it? But now Quiet Life becomes a path for sellers to exit something that might otherwise be a very illiquid investment.
Gotcha. Yeah. So with each of the transactions that you've purchased from Quiet Light and from me specifically, Ben, you've been in a situation where there have been multiple buyers. You've had to compete with other buyers that approached it and maybe pushed the value up against your offer.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach making offers and putting structures together and how you work with the seller in terms of making the deal a win-win for both you guys?
For sure. That's a great question. And as a buyer, you often don't know what, the seller, the Quiet Light and the seller have all the cards and know what's going on. But for me, I think it's two, maybe three things. And the first is personality. The second is about, just being upfront and clear, managing expectations. And the third is professionalism. So I'll touch a little bit on those. So with personality, I think in a situation where you and your clients are having two or three or five or 10 or how many bids, at the end of the day, the numbers are going to start to blend together a little bit. But there's a big, I think it's beyond just the number on the paper. There's a reason a buyer chooses to look for the seller and vice versa. There's a reason a seller, which is the buyer. Sometimes the personality fit is a big deal. because it's this dance of going from two complete strangers. You're there in the middle of managing everyone's expectations. And at the end of the day, it's two people having to work together on a transition for a few months. And so you can't have two completely incompatible personalities. So I think it's us being, you know, kind and considerate, but as well as getting that same vibe from the seller too. So that's a big part of it. You know, secondly, I talked about communication upfront. I think it's always been really important from the start to manage expectations and communicate, even if it's disappointing blips of information here and there that we have to communicate. As you know, Joe, we've been done this very stressful emotional sales. And so for me, what I've always done is have empathy and put myself in the shoes of a seller and know what would they want to know, what they might be thinking. And as you know, there have been times where in a stressful process, we've had to deliver news that wasn't the greatest. But the main thing is if we're communicating that and we're being clear about it, I think that's a big positive for you and your clients to hear. And finally, is the professionalism. I think that was a big part of what I learned from my, you know, I'm grateful to my former bosses and colleagues and learning that skill set. It's not just a buyer trying to get the lowest possible price and extracting value and, you know, punishing a seller for, you know, because every business out there is going to have positives and negatives. And so I can't sit here and talk only about the negative in order to drive down price and get a value. I approach it as a professionalism. Like we're here to, everyone's incentivized to get a deal done, the seller, you, the buyer. And so it's, for me, it's not about knocking down the flaws or the weaknesses of business. It's about being professional and understanding and valuing what the seller's done and the hard work they've put in to get a business you're interested in. So, you know, it's the personality that kind of jives with that too, but it's just being very clear, very communicative, very professional, and not trying to take advantage of the seller, because that's not what it's about at all. If you have to pay market or a little higher, if that's the end of what gets the business to you at the end of the day, you know, that's what's going to be valued by you and your client.
Yeah, let me touch on this just for those buyers out there that are wondering, how do you compete with an all-cash buyer? How do you compete with other buyers when there's multiple offers? Everything Ben just said is absolutely on target. And I'm going to talk about it as if I was the seller, because I have been a seller. When I sold my business through QuietLight in 2010, I had five or six conference calls with potential buyers, and two stand out. One, the guy was just a jerk. This is one that stands out. He was rude. He cut my business down. He didn't let me finish my sentences. And I kept thinking, why am I even on this call? If he makes me an offer, I'm not selling him the business.
Right.
He wasn't going to do it. The other one that stood out was the person that started the call with, hey man, thanks for creating this product line. I've actually used similar products and it's made a huge difference in my life. Thank you. And then he went on, actually one of the shortest conference calls that I had, but he was professional. He was, you use the word, kind. He was courteous and he actually ended up buying my business. And I was happy to do business with him. If he had offered me $10,000 less than the other guy, I would have taken it.
Yeah.
Simple.
No.
Because it's a choice. A lot of time sellers have choices, even when they have multiple offers. And I've been in another situation recently, not as the seller, but as the broker, where I had two offers, full price, $2.3 million-ish. And one was an SBA deal. One was all cash. The seller chose the SBA deal, even though he had to take a 10% note, because he really liked that seller. He was going to keep his staff in place, was going to run the business well, had just a good fit. The cash buyer, he felt like he was going to be really hard in due diligence, really hard in transition. He just didn't have time for that in his life. So keep that in mind, buyers, because it's really important. Now, Ben, I want to talk, we've done two deals together, and I don't want to talk about I don't want to reveal names here or anything like that. So we'll talk big picture stuff. You've heard me say it, and I'm not blowing up your ego or anything like that. I don't think you need it, but out of all the deals I've done, and I've done like 52, 53 million in total transactions now, you stand at the top in terms of professionalism, the way a buyer behaves and acts, and I'm always pointing people in your direction. There's a couple of others, and strangely enough, on the last deal we had, my two all-time favorite buyers were making offers. So it was really hard. It's you and the other guy, Matt. Matt, if you're listening, you're right up there. But on the first deal, we were in a situation where we had multiple offers. And it turned out that it was going to be much greater tax consequence to the seller than we realized initially, because he had a C corporation. Can you talk about what you did and how you pivoted to make that work for him, if you recall. I know it was 5 years ago, 4 years ago. Can you remember the details?
Yeah, I remember that coming up, I think, towards the beginning, middle of the process. And that's something that is often underrated. And it's maybe, you know, there's an inflection point probably if you have a business as a seller where you have to think about the tax implications of the depending on the corporation. But I think that's way beyond the scope of what we want to talk about today. But I remember for us, it came down to just being willing to accommodate the seller's desires as it relates to the tax. So it was a little bit less favorable for us from the buy side, but it still got us the business. I mean, at the end of the day, again, you're lining up offers. Joe and the seller are looking at everything and comparing everything. It's a competitive situation, and tax can be a big part of that. Net, when it comes down to all the fees that come out and the taxes that come out, there's a net cash. So for us, we were willing to say, okay, let's do something that benefits the seller because it's going to help nudge across. So from, you know, as it relates to the structure, that's going to be unique because when you're selling a business, the business has been formed years ago. There's not much you can do to look in the past. But when that exit happens, there's typically, you know, it's a stock or an asset sale. And, you know, is there the willingness on the other side of the quiet light table? Is the buyer willing to work with you that maximizes the value? And for some buyers, it may or may not make sense. But I would say based on that transaction in the digital world, as well as what I've seen in kind of in that institutional world, typically more often than not, if you're a seller and you're working with Joe, buyers should be willing to come to the table in terms of meeting what you would like and how you would like to structure that transaction. And more often than not, buyers will accommodate the seller. Not always, because there's sometimes going to be a unique quirk to a particular business. But again, those are nuances that aren't even willing. And that's tax experts and legal experts that think about tail risk and stuff. Generally speaking, though, a buyer like myself or a digital buyer is going to be willing to work with you. So it shouldn't be a big fear in the seller's mind, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And as you said, you work around the situation so that it benefits both of you. There have been situations in the last 6 years where I've had a buyer in due diligence try to take advantage and discount the price because of a certain situation. Everything was 100% laid out exactly as it should have been. There were no surprises, but they felt as though now that they have them under letter of intent, they're going to try to pivot and reduce the price. And it's just not the way that we work. Everything is fully disclosed up front. And in your situation, I specifically recall there was a change in the structure. It benefited the seller. It helped him out. And you were okay with that. It might have cost you an extra dollar or two or a thousand or two, whatever the number might have been. But in the long run, it got you the deal. It closed the transaction. And I believe it's worked out fairly well for you, correct?
Yeah, exactly. When you look back at the tax and you calculate it, it's something where, you know, if you're a bidder and you're a buyer and this is your goal, is to take over business and own a successful business, this is the minutia of the deals is the tax implication. So unless there's a particular quirk or nuance to a business because there's a liability or there's something unique about it, I think it's best to work with Joe and his clients in doing what's best for the seller. It's a big decision for them. It can be life-changing. It's emotional more often than not. And when it comes to these details, they can matter. So yeah, in the end, it's as you just you perfectly illustrated, Joe, it worked out best for him at the time and for us going forward.
I just have to repeat some of this, Ben, because it's, I don't know, it should be so obvious. For those listening, buyers, this information is coming from someone that has spent over $10 million on transactions. It's not, you know, he made a $100,000, $200,000 purchase. Each situation Ben has been in with me and with Quiet Light, it's been multiple offer situations where he's negotiating up against someone else and has bought the business by being a nice guy and thinking not only about himself, but about the seller as well. And he's gotten the deal done. The first one worked out great. Let's talk about the second one, because you are not even 30 days in at this point, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So this particular business, not going to name names, not going to talk multiples or anything like that, but I want to talk deal structure on this one in terms of funding, because we had a situation where it was going down one path and then we had to pivot.
Yeah.
And I was comfortable with pivoting because it was you.
Yeah.
You had set up an alternate path just in case this one doesn't go. I've got this one ready. And it took a little bit longer, but it worked out both for you. And you know what? The business was growing so fast that the seller got to keep a whole bunch more money because he got to keep it for an extra 30 days. Mm-hmm. But let's talk, if you will, a little bit about how you come up with funding. How do you structure a deal? Where do you get, unless you're sitting, are you sitting on millions and millions of money in your account?
Right? I wish. If I were, we'd be doing this. I'd be loving nothing more just to podcast all the time and do this all day long. Hopefully in the future, but no, I'm not.
So you're using other people's money.
In this case, yeah.
You learned about that from the investor world. So let's talk about that with someone that is, you know, new to this. They may have a few hundred thousand to invest and is looking to buy a $5 million business. How the heck do they do that? How do you
get that? Yeah. So first and foremost, guys, if you hit that situation, know that there's going to be some stress because you're managing expectations for Joe, for Joe's client, for the fund that's backing you, perhaps for a bank that's backing you in the fund. There's a lot of juggling. There's stress for Joe and the seller side, and there's stress for you. So that's gonna come up no matter what. But how does that come about? You know, just like almost anything private, it could be a real estate deal, it could be a restaurant or a bar, it could be a film project, it could be a private business. There's, you know, if there's, I wouldn't say the word lucky, but if you have a history with someone you know has capital behind them, that puts you in a spot. But even beyond that, you'd be surprised at the amount of just average, you know, guys. I came up in a pretty regular background, and it shocked me out there. There's a fair amount of people that just work hard and save their money. And if you can tell a compelling story of why you should do a transaction with Quiet Life, there's going to be a lot of support for you in that deal. But taking it back to this specific example that Joe and I worked on together, the stress for me was, and you know, I like to think of, as I said at the beginning of the call, I like to have empathy. I like to have professionalism. And that means doing things with honor. So for example, the capital of a former boss of mine, they were very interested in the deal, full support. And from the start, they said, okay, don't show this to anyone else. I want to back this deal. You've worked with Joe. You've been the face of it. I want to put my capital to work. That was it. Pretty much, right, Joe? Kind of not only that, but wasn't just me. I also wanted to introduce that person to Joe and Joe's clients such that they had a face.
And let me say right now, no names again, that sealed the deal for you. Again, we had multiple offers in this situation. And what you did was you brought in the money into the conference call with the seller. And so myself and the seller felt much more comfortable when you were bringing in other people's money, that those people got on the call, asked really professional questions, were professional, had the same kind of demeanor you did. And we just really liked them. It just made a difference for us. And liking who you're doing business with, it kind of matters. Right?
It matters a lot.
Because,
yeah.
As you said, there's a lot of stress. This is for the person that's selling the business, it's often can be a lifetime event sale. And they've got other people that they're promising things to and taking care of, and over promising and under delivering is never what people want to do.
Exactly.
You did that very well. So that particular buyer, the money though, it disappeared on us.
It disappeared. And that was, and the internal frustration that I had to bear during the process, and the recommendation of how to avoid that as a perhaps a representative of other money, is I knew from the start I could have made two or three or four calls just given my background, and there would have been backing. But I, out of respect, out of honor, when that person said, Ben, don't show this to anyone else, I took them at their word. I said, fine. Knowing that in the rare event, when rarities happen, it happened, they decided to back out, I was going to have to scramble and completely restart not only my process, but Joe's time and his client's time. And that was going to be frustrating for them. It was going to be frustrating for me. Now, I had confidence I would still be able to, but I knew we had lost a good 6 weeks of hard work from everyone's part. So the first thing, the first piece of advice I have, if you're using other people's money, if it's a rich uncle, if it's a rich fund, if it's cobbled three or four people, I would say always the money man, the person with the account, the big account, get them involved early. Have them meet the seller, as Joe said. It makes a big difference rather than you just saying, I'm an agent on behalf of someone else. I'm representative. I'm an executive on behalf of someone else. In this world, it makes a huge difference. The second piece of advice, as Joe just said, is if you're really serious and you're the guy passionate and wanting to do the deal, it matters that you want to have your ducks in a row and potentially have a contingency plan, as I did, should that first fall through. Now, like I said, I put my own self in a scramble due to how I do business, and that was respecting them, saying I'm not showing it to anyone else. We're going down this buyer path together. And they backed out. They kind of put me, and as Joe, you know, they profusely apologized and felt bad for you. They felt bad for me. They felt bad for the seller.
They were very professional.
Yeah. Yeah. They knew the implications of whatever analogy you want to use. They knew the bad pile of what that they had put us all in. Yeah. But as you, I think you sensed it, Joe, and I think the seller sensed it, that I was so determined to not abandon and not underdeliver, that I was willing to do almost anything to make sure the deal would conclude and have a happy ending, which it did. And it actually had a slightly favorable outcome because I was personally willing to give up a few things in terms of escrow, in terms of amount, that they were a little bit more, I would say, not strict on, but more, their world was a little bit more maybe weighted to the buyer. And I was more empathetic to Joe and Joe's client. So it ended up being a win. They had, Joe and Joe's client had, they waited an extra month, but it ended up being worth it to them materially on a money perspective. So yeah, so advice to buyers is, bring the money people in early, bring them to the table. Don't hide them. There's no, you're not protecting or hide, there's no upside to hiding it. Be upfront. Communicate the negative. When we had to do a three-way call, it was Joe, myself, and my former colleague, boss, and they communicated that bad news. But we had to. We just don't want to be sitting here as a buyer or a potential bidder, having Joe and his client wonder what's going on. And then thirdly, as a buyer, if you can and you really want that business, again, have that plan B, have that plan C ready to go, ready to pull the trigger should something bad in plan A happen.
Yeah, the key thing with the outcome there in terms of communicating the negative and them calling, not just an email, but a call, and you were on the line, they were on the line, and conveyed the message that things went sideways where they were and they can't continue with the deal. The outcome in the long run is, if you ever call me again and love another listing and bring them in, I'm going to listen because they were professional and they called and I'd love to do business with them. I know, and you know, why they said no to this one. It wasn't their choice. They had to say no. Mm-hmm. But there was logic behind it to a certain degree, but it worked out. Again, like you said, we pivoted. The next step was, another person really with the purse strings in a sense. And the first thing we did was what? We scheduled a conference call.
Exactly.
We had to instill confidence in the seller of the business that we're not just dragging our knuckles, that the business is still of interest to you and to the other source of funding. And so we had a call. We set new expectations and managed them well. You actually gave us at one point daily updates, which I think must have been driving you nuts. Because sometimes there wasn't much to report.
But yeah, sometimes there's not much. Yeah, as you know, these processes just happen and there's a process to them. There's not always a daily update. It's not like there's a daily sales report. So
right.
Yeah, sometimes you're kind of like, okay, this is the most minor thing ever to report in. But again, buyers, I recommend the communication. And not just any communication, but it's a human being. It's not just a transaction. So the vibe, the connection, it's the managing of expectations too, good and bad. You don't want to be in a situation. And of the first business we bought with Joe, as the operator of that business, that's how I've chosen to run things. We get dozens of emails a day from our customers who want a product feature. It's a software company, so they want a product feature. And always we're upfront. We say, we'll add it to the roadmap. We'll add it to the vote. We can't promise it'll ever be built. And that's, I think, a big thing as a buyer. You don't want to overpromise and underdeliver, because it's not just the client's time and their hopes and dreams, but it's Joe's. I mean, he's the gatekeeper. He's the advisor. He's the one who's been through this and advised so many big companies and so many professional sellers who have built unique businesses that you don't want to waste. As a buyer, you do not want to waste Joe's time if you can. So managing, not just putting out an offer for everything you see, not just doing conference calls for everything you see, really waiting to make the right targeted strike for what's best for you so that you can judiciously use his time and his advice. And I think that's a big part, is the managing of expectations.
Yeah. The advice I always give is, to buyers, look at as many possible listings that you can, so that you know the right fit when it comes along and that you can act quickly. You don't want to be in a situation where you're sort of looking part-time and then, you like one, and then you have to go find funding for it. by the time you come back, if it's a great business, it's going to be gone. The other thing you absolutely don't want to do is be in a situation, like Ben said, where you don't bring the money person forward if there's somebody else that's doing the funding. Even if you're doing an SBA deal, there's two of you putting the 10 or 15% down. We had a situation recently where that was the situation. Multiple offers, this two partners were chosen. And one of the partners was not on the initial conference call and decided to walk away because of one particular situation, which was fully disclosed in the client interview. It's all there, but he didn't bother looking in advance. So, you know, the broker is thinking to himself, look, and he gave the guy advice. He's like, look, you can't have this happen. You call me again. And if you're making an offer and someone else is making an offer, my seller's going to say, what do you know about the two of them?
Yeah.
Broker's going to have to say, well, I had a deal with these guys and they just walked away in due diligence. His partner flaked.
Yeah.
Partner still around? Yes. So you want to be making use of the advisor broker's time as well. As Ben said, we're all busy. We all have a lot of clients to work with. We work with as many buyers as we do sellers, probably more actually buyers. And some of them, like Ben, is just going to rise to the surface. When Ben sends me an email and has an interest in a listing, I'm like, oh man, I love doing business with Ben. Always works out great. Sellers love him, and you're going to get more attention than somebody that might have walked away on a deal for some strange flaky reason.
Yeah. Right? And then in that institutional world that I came from originally, that same thing happens where it could be a huge, huge company, but sometimes firms get a reputation for saying one thing and doing another. And they become the shop where they're going to, in an LOI, they say X, Y, and Z, but you know, at the end of the day, it's going to turn out to be something less than XYZ, and it doesn't work out as well for the seller. And so that reputation sticks. And I think from the sell side too, I think from a buyer, what I can unilaterally say is both having closed on deals, bid on deals, and looked but passed because it wasn't the right fit. I say this not because we're just doing this podcast, but QuietLight, I think, unilaterally has the best digital businesses and web-based businesses out there, that their reputation speaks for itself, their ability to conduct. As a buyer too, I've been talking about professionalism, what you need to do, but it's a two-sided coin. Sellers and the sell side needs to be doing the same. And I've seen situations from other shops where there was not the most scrupulous behavior by the advisor, the broker, and burned the buyers a little bit. So it's a two-sided coin, and it's a trust issue. And at the end of the day, we are all humans. Tiny mistakes are made maybe here and there, but it's honesty, it's communication. It's a big part of that. Use the word vibe, it's just the personality fit is what's going to get things done. I mean, there's no reason to be cold and cagey and do what you can to get extract value in this transaction. If a business is the right fit for you as a buyer, you can pay, you know, 95% or 105% or whatever it is around that price, and driving down the price and making the seller and Joe angry isn't going to win in the long run. What's going to win in the long run is you taking over that business and operating it with hard work and honesty and integrity and all the things that make the customers continue to be happy. That's, you know, if you overpay a little bit or you don't get them to drive down the price because you're not insulting them, but it gets you the deal, like that's a very important consideration.
I think we have to finish it on that right there, Ben. That was the best advice I think, you know, anybody could possibly give potential buyers.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, man, I appreciate your time. I know you're a busy guy. Thanks for sharing your time. I look forward. It might be another 3 or 4 years before we do this again.
Yeah.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much, Ben.
No, thanks. Yeah, thanks for your time too. And thanks for being, again, for the great guy in the space. So look forward to working together in 3-4 years from now.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.